I started it exactly as you would think, which is effectively, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I knew this wasn't even a real recipe. This was like some chicken scratch on a piece of paper, for the most part, in my wife's head.
I'm your host, Dave Knox, and this is Predicting the Turn, a show that helps business leaders meet their industry's inevitable disruption head on.
Welcome to another episode of Predicting the Turn. Today, we sit down with Mike Adair, who is the founder and CEO of REDS. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
For sure. So I want to start with the founding story of how you started REDS and what inspired you to launch the business.
Yeah, so it's a pretty crazy story. And like probably most founders, it happened by accident. But I had been working in a career in finance for 5 or 6 years after college and just woke up one day and decided there had to be more to life than mutual funds and had no idea what that meant, but ended that career and slowly moved into the next phase of my life, which ended up being a journey back to business school and a lot of hikes in the woods with my dog Red and trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And my wife made a great burrito. My dog's name is Red and was taking a really neat entrepreneurship class and kind of had to have a project by the next day. And next thing I know, I made a few burritos with my wife and named the project REDS. And that was what turned into a 15-year journey of a lot of fun, crazy ups and down, and a lot of exploration.
So going from a homemade burrito that tastes really good to a burrito and now a frozen food company that has really transformed that freezer aisle, that's not a straight line by any means. So how'd you take that initial great homemade burrito and start turning it into something that you could sell in retail?
There's one little piece I guess I did leave out about the starting, which is one of the things that I loved was I love consumer products goods, not because I'm some crazy consumer of goods by any stretch, but I love the idea of being this person or this team behind the scenes that could make a product or a good for people and try relentlessly to be the best at that thing. And so that product could get out in the world and interact with, at the time I was thinking of hundreds of consumers and eventually thousands and beyond, but we could have the ability to be the best in the world at making that product so that we could hopefully have a little bit of a positive impact on all of those people's lives, help them navigate through their day and their week and their life day to day. And so I started it exactly as you would think, which is effectively, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I knew this wasn't even a real recipe. This was like some chicken scratch on a piece of paper for the most part in my wife's head. And we had to figure out how to actually make a recipe and then actually turn that into something that could be repeated over time, the manufacturing facility. And then how do we actually put that in a package? And how do we actually put stickers or packaging or film or whatever? And so it was exactly how you would think it would be. It was literally just piece by piece trying to solve one problem at a time until all of a sudden you've solved enough problems where you have a product that you're holding and then you can, you know, start solving the next set of problems, which is how do I get this onto the shelves? And then how do I convince people to buy it? And what's the right price point? And then who's going to make this longer term? And oh, by the way, how do I figure out how to make money? So those are all the little pieces that just like today, you start looking at all of the problems you need to solve, prioritizing them and just taking them piece by piece.
I love that. Talk me through that journey of the last almost 15 years of building this business. You started with the burritos. How's the portfolio evolved over the years?
So it's evolved tremendously. And I think like any kind of food company or any entrepreneur in the food and beverage space, you've got a lot of ideas. We're all full of innovation and excitement, and we want to get all these different ideas into the world. You've got to make sure that the most important thing at the end of the day is that product, right? And so if we don't get it right and people have a bad experience, they won't come back. And ultimately the brand REDS will have kind of a negative association in people's minds. And so we spent, you know, quite a bit of time trying to make sure that the product, and we've done this repeatedly over the last 15 years, is really focusing on the actual product that's going to get onto the shelves and trying to make that as good as we possibly can. Now, don't get me wrong, we have launched a ton of the wrong items that didn't resonate with consumers. And so we launched big burritos out of the gate and I thought they were super delicious, but the price point was too high. We launched some quesadillas, we launched some bowls, we launched a whole bunch of items, whether they were the wrong platform or the wrong flavor profile. And so slowly but surely, we've been really relentless internally on trying to make sure that we are delivering the best thing we possibly can, and then listening to the feedback. Consumers are going to give you feedback whether you want it or not, which is, are they buying it? Are they telling you they like it? Does it need to be smaller, bigger, more cheese, less cheese, more meat, whatever the nuances are? We've been internalizing that feedback day in and day out for the whole time, and trying to then make the products as best as we possibly can, and then building on that, right? So when you've got an item that works, really supporting that item to make sure that we get it onto enough shelves. And then items that aren't working and people are, you're not excited about them, you got to kill those off as fast as you can so that you can support the winners. And then over time, you start learning a lot more about what's going to work with a consumer, what they like and don't like, so that our innovation pipeline can get a lot tighter. And we've been really fortunate over time to survive that journey, because most people don't, and kind of fine tune our, we've always been in frozen, but we fine tune the assortment to live in the snack portfolio, your chicken, your steak, your carnitas, all of those kind of snack items. And then we've also been super successful in the breakfast category. So it started with breakfast burritos, like your turkey sausage, your Canadian bacon, and traditional bacon or sausage. And then we've evolved that into the breakfast sandwich line, which has been super successful for us and a ton of fun to play in that category. So that's been about 15 years of evolution into about 30 seconds, but it's been a lot of fun.
Talent is a big part of predicting the turn. And as we talk about talent, I wanted to mention one of our sponsors, Hunt Club. Imagine the power of the best marketers in the world helping you to find your next marketing leader. That's the power of Hunt Club. Hunt Club is a new category of talent company that powers the network of experts, connectors, and business leaders to help you find the best talent. Let's face it, recruiting hasn't changed with the times. Hunt Club is changing the recruiting game by leveraging technology and crowdsource referrals to find you the best people possible for your company. Stop paying job boards that don't work or recruiting firms that recycle the same active candidates. Partner with Hunt Club.
You mentioned you've really stayed true to that freezer aisle in a lot of large part. What's changed in the freezer aisle over the years?
So the freezer aisle continues to evolve, and it's like, strangely, everyone thinks of the freezer aisle, or certainly they did 20, 30 years ago, as like this kind of a, it's like a place you had to go, but you didn't really want to go. You've got this freezer, it's cold, you got glass behind in between the products. And there was this perception of low-end food, a lot of sodium and highly processed, and kind of this whole negative experience. And slowly but surely, that has really evolved to being a much more exciting place with a lot more better premium options. And we've seen that kind of in real time. There's a lot more premium items like Reds. And the consumer is starting to really understand that this is an amazing place to shop. Not only can I get super like nutrient dense items that are super delicious, super convenient, they've got a ton of premium. And now with the evolution of all of these reheating devices like air fryers and toaster ovens and turbo chefs and all these fun and exciting things, I can put a ton of time and energy into making something as good as we possibly can. And then the consumer can then reheat that in a matter of minutes to an incredible experience that is more or less very similar to what you could do, make it from scratch on your own, because that's effectively what we're doing. We're just doing it a little bit bigger scale. So it's been super exciting. I think I don't know if we're, what inning we're in here, but we're probably in the third or fourth inning. And so I think it's going to be really fun and exciting over the course of the next 5, 10, 15 years as that tide continues to rise and more people realize how great the offerings are in the freezer aisle and how amazing the actual products can be. So it's been pretty fun.
With that, over the 15 years, you've seen entrepreneurship when it comes to launching a food beverage change quite a bit. If you were in the shoes of an entrepreneur today, how would you approach that first concept of having an idea, wanting to get in food? Where would you suggest they go to start building their business?
Man, that's a tough one. The great thing about food entrepreneurship is it's so accessible, right? So everyone's got a grandmother or a sister or brother or an uncle or something that makes something really special, right? And that then creates a lot of excitement around entrepreneurship in food and beverage. That's the positive, right? So then the negative is that exact same issue, right? So it is so accessible that so many people try and come into the world, come into our world and start companies. And I think that I love both, but it does make it highly competitive because there are so many people coming into the world trying to create brands. I think the most important thing is just try and make sure that whatever that product is, that the world does need it, you know, that you are providing a great solution and that the audience is going to be big enough and engaged enough where they're going to love that and buy it repeatedly and that they're going to want to tell their friends about it. And that's something that you actually can make on a consistent basis and you can make it at a price point that is palatable, right? So we obviously play in the premium world. And so premium ingredients, semi-traditional items that, you know, antibiotic and hormone-free, non-GMO, all of that fun stuff, that's more or less just how things were grown for thousands of years before we got into the highly processed manufacturing and growing. And so we're just trying to provide that. And we're trying to do it as cost-effectively as possible. So it's difficult for us to compete against the super kind of highly processed stuff, but we're okay with that. We're trying to deliver something that we think is an improved or better experience. And so I think I mentioned this quite a bit earlier, is that as consumers and entrepreneurs in this world think about starting a business, make sure that you focus on the product first. Because I've seen so many entrepreneurs all of a sudden are like, I got an idea and I'm super excited. And they get a product and all of a sudden they're so anxious to get it on the shelves and try and sell it and market it. And they spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on trying to spread the word of marketing something that is not ready yet. And so if you don't have the right product at the right price point, I always use the analogy of it's like putting gasoline on an ember, right? It's just going to put it out. So you've got to make sure that you actually support that little fire. And when it gets big enough, then you can pour some gasoline on it via the marketing activity and it will help it grow tremendously. But if you don't focus on the product first and foremost, then it's going to be a tough challenge.
So related to that, it's always a debate, I think, with emerging food brands of what's the right approach for also making it? Do I go do my own manufacturing? Do I do a co-packer? How do I think about the logistics and the operations of it? You had an even more complex because you're dealing with a frozen product, which cold supply chain is a whole different kind of beast. So how is somebody getting into this? Did you wrestle with those own challenges and think about your approach for the business?
Oh, yeah, I've wrestled with them for years and we still wrestle with them. So if I'd known what I know now, I probably would have started a vegetarian chip company or something that's a heck of a lot easier from a manufacturing and regulatory perspective. But we ended up having two really big challenges. One is we've got meat in the products. Everything we do has to be made in a USDA regulated facility. And then second, you mentioned, which is the frozen aspect. So those are two, you know, pretty big hurdles that we needed to overcome, trying to figure out the logistics of all of that. The bad news is they're pretty big hurdles to overcome. The good news is that it probably creates a little bit of a larger barrier to entry into the frozen than it does some other categories. I think for most people, the key is, I've seen this go both ways, and a lot of entrepreneurs want to go into self-manufacturing out of the gate. And my caution to that is fixed overhead associated with manufacturing is very real, and it's very hard to overcome. People like myself, entrepreneurs are all optimists. And so we think we can scale often much faster than we actually can. And the key to thriving is surviving. And so you've got to be able to extend every dollar you've got, an extra day, an extra week, an extra month. And so be very careful about the fixed overhead that you're actually committing to. And one of the biggest potential fixed overhead in the early years is manufacturing. So if you are able to find a good co-manufacturing partner that can make the product to your specifications and they can make it super high quality and they can be a good partner, I would definitely recommend that people go down that path in the beginning. And we did that. We ended up having probably three or four at least co-manufacturing partners in the first 5 or 6 years. And we had some really good partners and I'm very appreciative of those partnerships. But in our world, I knew that if I wanted to build the company that I really wanted to build, I wanted to control and own quality in a way that you're never quite going to get. And maybe this is just me being a control, but I wanted to own the manufacturing so that I could just sleep at night knowing we are doing everything possible to give the consumer the best experience. And it also enabled us to control the capacity. If a customer wanted some new innovation, we were able to pivot or move on a dime really fast in order to be super customer centric. And so we went down the path of self-manufacturing about 8 years ago. And that has been a very hard thing to do. But at the end of the day, I think it was by far the best decision we ever made, because it did enable us to do all of those things, right? Enable us to really step change our quality. And as you continue to grow, you're able to absorb all of the fixed overheads associated with self-manufacturing and all of the pains and issues that come along with it. But if we had done it too early, it would have drowned us, right? We wouldn't have had enough volume in order to cover all the fixed overhead. And so all of our cash would have just been constantly sucked into the manufacturing world. And we wouldn't have had enough money left in order to invest in people or invest in kind of innovation and some of the things that are critical when you're just getting a food or beverage brand going. So I would say, if you can, figure out the most cost-effective way to do it. And usually that's down the path of co-manufacturing. And if you are going to self-manufacture, just do it as light and lean as you possibly can. Because I keep harping on this, you've got to get the product right. And a lot of times, including us, you might have an amazing product, but it might be the wrong one. It might be the wrong flavor, the wrong size, the wrong price, whatever it is. And so you've got to get product into the world and have people taste it and give you feedback so that you can make some improvements or changes and make sure that you're nailing the product that you're to the most amount of people.
That makes total sense. Over the years, you've taken a lot of different approaches for funding the business as well. When you look at that and all the options available, what do you think about the difference of, you talked about putting the fuel on the brand from a marketing, the approach of bootstrapping versus raising from venture capital versus later on with private equity? How should somebody think about the choices of what their financing might lead to the decisions they have to make for their business?
So every business is a little bit different. So I guess I'll just try and speak to the best I can from my experience. And I would beg, borrow, and steal as long as you can, bootstrap, which by the way is what I mean by that, bootstrap as long as you can. And what I've seen a lot of brands do is they bring on venture private equity partner pretty early, and inevitably the business is going to need more money. And so before you know it, the venture private equity firm kind of more or less owns the brand and is making a lot of the decisions in regards to innovation, or they want to spend a lot of money on marketing and they want to do it just creates a bit of a divergence that ends up killing a lot of brands. And so I think in this food and beverage world, there are very few companies that all of a sudden catch lightning in a bottle and go from 0 to 50 million overnight. Don't get me wrong, it does happen. But the more time that you can get over days, months, weeks, years to try and learn and grow and make good decisions and learn from bad decisions, that and the more ownership that you can keep, will it creates financial disciplines. You don't have a lot of money to spend, the chances are you're not going to spend it, right? And so every time I was fundraising, I was always thinking about just trying to raise as little as I could, but as much as I needed in order to get more proof, more progress made. So whether it was I needed enough money to last 6 to 12 to 18 months, I would just try and raise the amount I thought and probably a little bit more, because the worst thing you can do is raise too little. And then all of a sudden you need to raise money again before you've had enough time to prove certain things, because investors always love progress. So if you're on 200 shelves and you need time to get onto 1,000 or whatever it is, I've got 4 items and I've launched to 8 items, you've got to have enough time and money to be able to get to that next milestone. So my recommendation is always to raise as little as you can, but as much as you need to get to the next milestone. And then all of a sudden you're going to find yourself in a situation where you have got more options, right? So the best thing you can possibly do is just raise as little as possible and become profitable, in which case you can write your own, you can do whatever you want. But in the consumer price good world, being profitable before 50, 60 million sales is really hard. It's just a competitive world with a lot of barriers to entry and fees and slotting and promotional activity and stuff, just trying to build it. Once you do get big enough though, finding that semi-institutional, if you're able to continue to just invest with family and friends, then I would recommend that. But You do need advice, right? So whether it's coming from an investor or advisors or mentors or whatever, you know, you got to make sure that you're building enough of a network of people that can give you really good advice.
Yeah, that's great advice right there. So where do you think what's next for Reds?
Crazy. Literally, today is my daughter's 15th birthday. And I started this business when she was 3 months old. And my wife and I were joking last night. We were like, I cannot believe we have a 15-year-old. It just made us feel really old. I'm 44. I probably love what I do more than I ever have. We have an incredible team, which is something that I really don't want to take for granted, because in the early years, you don't have enough money to build a great team. And so you're putting out fires, taking out the trash, and then going on sales calls all within the morning. So that to me has been a super fun next chapter of constantly surrounding ourselves with the absolute best and brightest, most experienced people. And now I can be a little bit more of the dumb entrepreneur in the room who's just full of passion and ideas, trying to help work with people who are better, smarter, faster, smarter than I am, which has been really fun. It's like a whole new chapter that has given me all of this confidence that we can build a $1 billion brand. And we play in, frozen is a huge world and huge, we play in two very big categories. And we think the consumer deserves more premium items in this world. And so I think, like I said, we're staying in frozen. We play in snack and we play in breakfast, and we're going to continue to double and triple and quadruple down within the worlds that we play in and continue to grow those categories and bring really what we think are really solid offerings for the whole household, right? So whether you live by yourself or you've got a family of six or seven, having options that solve the needs for all of those different people it sounds ridiculous, but to me, that's super exciting. When I walk down the street or I walk into a grocery store or at a family gathering or whatever, and somebody's, oh, this child, this person loves that item, this person loves that item. Like, to me, there's nothing cooler than that, because it's, A, I love all of those items. They're like my kids. To have somebody feel that connection with an item that you've made and multiple people throughout a family is the coolest thing in the world. And I don't know what else I would do. I feel super, super lucky that I fell into this world, and I'm probably more obsessed with it now than I ever have been. And I think we got a really neat opportunity in front of us, and I'm super excited about it.
Awesome. I think that is a perfect commentary to end on there. So congrats on everything you've accomplished over the 15 years with Reds, and really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and share the journey.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like the show, hit that rating and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And for more resources, head over to predictingtheturn.com.